apparently Texas is opening up 100% now. So we got a lot to talk about.
Yeah, not only opening up 100%, but opening up 100% and rescinding the mask mandate as well.
So I kind of want to, on the one hand, put head in hands and cry about all that we could do and could have done and will still do. On the other hand, I feel like if you step outside yourself, it's kind of fascinating to be living through a real-time human experiment, right? Every horror movie ever made, every public health movie ever made, pretty much got us to this point, and now we're figuring it out as we go. So I want to hear from you about your thoughts, your experience. Today we're going to talk about a variety of fairly geeky things. So we'll start with you sort of introducing yourself to those who don't already know you, but talking about you and a couple of your neighbors have been really on the front line of trying to get the data from the vaccine site to the vaccine registry, where it ultimately needs to go. We're going to talk about why. And then I kind of want, to the degree that you feel comfortable, we can be as politically correct as we need, but do some truth telling, because I think the biggest problem is that one Facebook post about where data needs to go elicits four or five different names of systems, and people don't know what's real. And I think that's a problem that we have right now.
I've never done data entry as a job, as a primary job, but I would have to assume the people that normally do data entry, so like these vaccination sites that are doing thousands and thousands of, or tens of thousands of people a day or a week, they probably have a group of individuals that are doing this data entry, and they're probably not paid on the accuracy of it, they're paid on the volume.
That's right.
So when they see something that pops up and says, yeah, this is the person, I would say probably that they are going to be like, oh, cool, click the button and not really necessarily go and verify everything is correct.
Well, and again, I think that goes to the question of how would they even know what's the source of truth, right? If you're a person that's brought
Right.
in, like they've brought in places like Los Angeles, exactly, and we know elsewhere in the Houston area, armies of secretaries, people who are brought in as typists to do exactly what you just described, what would they even know to use? What do they have to reference? So before we get into that, tell me a little bit about, tell the world about you, Joe. So what you do a lot of different things, and you've got the day job, you've got your consulting work that you've done, that sort of you try to keep, and obviously community paramedicine medicine's been a passion. So give us a couple minutes on you and what makes you tick.
Yeah, so my official job title here at ESD 48 Fire Department is community or battalion chief of community medicine. That was not what I was originally hired for. Originally, I was brought in. I have a history or a background of I've been a paramedic since '96. I've been a registered nurse since 2012. ER, ICU, and flight nursing background. That's pretty much what brought me to Texas was working for Memorial Hermann Life Flight as a flight nurse. And then I was brought on here back in September of 2018 to start up the community paramedic program and kind of get that ball
As a
rolling.
full-time focus, like that was your
Yeah,
goal.
that was my full-time focus. So that was
Awesome.
really what my job was. So we got that going, and then my job has kind of morphed into, well, with the nursing background and everything, why don't you do infection control? And at the time, prior to last March, that wasn't a very labor-intensive job. And the running joke around here is
Joke's
always,
on you, man.
yeah, the running joke around here is nobody knew what I did until last March. So,
Fair enough.
and I kind of liked it that way. But yeah, so. That's kind of that job has kind of morphed into infection control, community paramedicine, the EMS arm or the medical arm of the community risk reduction in the fire department. So CPR classes, stop the bleed, fall prevention, blood drives, that type of stuff. Because we are very heavily community engaged in a community risk reduction department as well, not only EMS but on the suppression side.
So, by the way, just as a, I mean, what you're describing, because I didn't realize, I confess, I didn't realize that you were in the air too. I mean, that's about as far away from air EMS, right, and critical care as you can get. How does that, just before you tell me even more, I'm just fascinated by that. Like, how do you miss it? And sort of how does it feel to go from, you know, in it, on the ground, in the air, and now you're basically taking care of the local community and making sure that they know who to call and, like, where to show up? Is that a culture shock?
Right.
Or did you know what you wanted to do?
I wouldn't say it's necessarily a culture shock, because really community paramedicine is kind of a hybrid between nursing care and paramedicine. You know, and it's not a surprise to me that a lot of the people that run community paramedic programs have a nursing background.
Sure.
At least in our area here, a lot of the people that run the community paramedic programs in the departments that have them, I think every single one of them is at least an RN. So, you know, as far as the critical care stuff, I mean, I have done the intensive care, critical care stuff for so long that I'm at the point in my life where, yeah, I do miss aspects of it, but the draw of being able to make my own schedule and actually be sleep at home every night and not have to be necessarily on call, well, until I'm on call infection control officer and during a pandemic, not having to be on call on weekends and holidays.
Jokes on you, buddy.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Yeah, it's been a long year. But yes, that's kind of how I got into it. And I like to do innovative things. I like to be a part of innovative things, and to have the opportunity to basically create something that there's a gap in the service. So there was a gap between people being discharged from the hospital. And where this all started was we looked at reducing readmission rates. That's what we kind of focused on with initially. So we picked the STEMI and NSTEMI group. There wasn't a whole lot of follow-up with those individuals. And we wanted to see if we could make a dent in that population. And what we ended up doing in a 7-month period is we reduced 3 years in a row, the hospital that we worked with was Houston Methodist West. Their readmission rate for STEMIs and NSTEMIs was 15.8%, which is right around the national average. The national average is 16%. We were able to reduce that in a 7-month period to 8.6%.
Oh, by half. Okay.
Almost by half. Yeah. I mean, and, you know, and it was really, it is a little bit different because, you know, we have all these wonderful toys here at our department, and we're carrying whole blood. We're, you know, we have all kinds of different things that we do that are cutting edge. And the stuff that I was doing was real basic. I mean, it was patient education. It was finding out what are the barriers that people are facing when they go home from the hospital that are causing them to not be able to do follow-up appointments, not be able to get medications, not be able to understand what the dietary restrictions are now, and kind of overcome that stuff and just provide education. I mean, I tell people that start to do this job with us, 95% of what you're going to do is you're just going to sit down and you're going to talk to somebody, and you need to listen to what they're telling you and figure out what it is that they need and provide that need.
There's kind of a status quo understanding for years about what these programs can be. And what I've basically said, which I think touches a lot on what you just described, is that it's not a clinical program. It's a data program, right? Because whether you roll up 911 hot code 3 or you roll up in a QRV, you know, and take a, you know, basically a return to the home visit, right? Is the only difference is, do you know your patient before you get there? Right? If you show up with a CAD call, you have no idea what you're showing up to. But if you're showing up to somebody and you know, like, I was here 3 days ago and I can, you know, hey, did you take these meds? Did you get the food that you needed? Did you check in with whoever? You know, that is really the essence of the program. And I think that that's ruffled some feathers at the idea that some of the politics of community paramedicine have butt into the idea that it's nursing care. And so not EMS. And I basically said, well, what if it's a supplement, right? Because you're going in to someplace, you can go in very comfortably into someplace where you may know the person, but you don't know what you're going to see today. Because this person may be schizophrenic, right? They may be strung out, right? They may be having a significant, you know, hypoxia problem today. And you don't know what the context is going to be. So you're going into an unknown with some context. And that's something that 911 doesn't do well per se, because it doesn't necessarily know who the patient is, and nursing care doesn't necessarily do well because they don't necessarily have all the tools to respond, right, to an unknown situation. You put these two together, and you've got one heck of a niche.
Well, and not only that, with the nursing care, because a lot of the initial, I don't even really want to say pushback, because really didn't get a lot of pushback, but the initial pushback would, for lack of a better term, would be that, well, it's similar to home health. Like, home health does the same thing. It's like, well, a lot of the people that I saw with this program, they don't qualify for home health, you know? So if you're a 45-year-old that had a heart attack, and you go home and you have a full-time job and you have a family and you don't have any medical needs that you necessarily, or don't have insurance, you might not even qualify for home health. So, but we can supplement those, even the people that qualify for it, because
then of course there's the idea that some of your patients, their home may be this bridge. Right. I mean, you know,
how many right. Patients? Like we had a guy that lived in his vehicle in a parking lot of a grocery store. Exactly. And we knew where to find him.
Yeah.
You know, we knew how to access. Yeah. We knew how to get access to him. But even so, like, the home health model has restrictions too, because they're paid a monthly amount. Say it's $5,000. You know, we're going to give you $5,000 to manage this patient this month. If it only costs you $3,000 to manage the patient, then your company can pocket the other $2,000. But if it costs you $8,000, we're not giving you the extra three, so it's going to cost you money. Whereas we're not bound by the time constraint. You know, there were patients, I mean, my average visit was 30 to 45 minutes, but there were patients where I sat there and talked to them for 3 hours because they just had that many questions and required that much education.
For you. All right. So bring it back. You were starting this, you were telling me about community risk reduction, fire department, right. And sort of, so now a year ago, you know, your job description changes. Before we get into process.
Well, control, it didn't change. It just became a little bit more relevant.
Sure. The spotlight yeah. turned on, right?
Yeah.
So I think one of the things that I try to do, so the name of my podcast is Sacred Cows and Data Cubes, right? And we'll get to the data part. But I think the sacred cow bit is really about trying to shine some truth-telling light on there's the party line, whatever that party line is, and then there's the on-the-ground experience. So you and I have been in this trench since like April of last year.
Right.
So give the world a sense of in ESD 48's coverage area and then expanded to Harris County and expanded to Texas. What has been the reality that you've experienced in terms of the evolution of the job, the tasks, sort of the process that got us to this point where now we can talk about registries and vaccination and appointments and all that? I mean, obviously it's been a ride.
Well, yeah. So I think one of the first things that needs to be said, and I think this is what a lot of people don't realize, and I actually just had this conversation today with somebody here, is that this is truly the first time that we're seeing the scientific process play out in front of the public and very transparent in the public from the beginning to the end. Normally what happens is when these things happen, there's a lot of kind of behind the scenes type work, and it's not that it's hidden or not accessible, but people just really don't care about it. They just want, I don't care how you got there. I just want the end result. You just tell me what I need to do.
Yep.
This is the first time that, number one, I think if this had happened in a non-election year, I think it would have been a very, very different result of what we would have. I think that this became very, very politicized on both sides, and that for good or for bad, change some things and really entrench some opinions that people have and some misopinions or misinformation that people have. But, you know, what the general public, that to me, the changing of guidelines and the changing of what has been put out, the information that's been put out, that doesn't seem odd to me, because in medicine, that's what happens. We see something, we learn what we can about it, we issue, okay, this is what we're going to do, this is what the treatment is, this is what the precautions are, then we research it, then we peer review it, then we look at, okay, is that good, is that bad, is it working, is it not working, okay, if it's not working, what do we need to do different? And you need to be okay as a medical provider and as a researcher to say that, hey, what I initially did isn't entirely correct, and there's a better way to do it. And I think that's the piece that's missing here with a lot of this. And I mean, you'll never see any politician on either side say that their opinion or the way that they were doing it was incorrect and that there was a better way to do it. It's just not going to happen. And that's where you get these deeply entrenched views that sometimes are just...
Are you basically... So are you suddenly you're suggesting that what we're essentially doing is watching the sausage being made, right? We're in the kitchen.
Right. Yeah.
And is that a function of, you know, a lot of people, it's a very interesting point, man. There's a lot of people who have been talking about, you know, H1N1 and SARS before and all these things. And I guess one of the main distinctions, of course, is this. I mean, it's constant access to social media and podcasting and blogs. And, you know, I was a media guy before I was in this business. And I think people don't really appreciate the power of media for good and bad, but in and of itself, it's nothing. It's just a tool, right? Some people say that about me. Different story. Right. But, you know, the idea that you now have access to that, and so it sounds like what you're describing is the idea that someone somewhere would have been inside the CDC office and now can take a snippet of something and post it to somewhere without it going through communication channels, which on the one hand opens up transparency, on the other hand opens up transparency. And so you end up with a messy process that people take out of context because they still don't understand what the chemical formula of water is, et cetera.
Right. And this is where your confirmation bias enters, because you now have whether you're correct or incorrect or whatever your opinion is, everybody has their opinion about what they believe is their truth. And they're going to take, like you said, those snippets that fit the narrative that they believe, and they're gonna promote that as their truth. The arguments that people make about things is the confirmation bias part comes in. Because they can take snippets of these things that fit what they want to believe is the truth, and they can kind of manipulate that or misinform people with that information.
Did we do the same thing before? Like, that's what I was wondering. Like, you know, you've been in the industry long enough to have seen some of these arcs. I remember a similar, not to this degree, but a similar fever around Ebola. Have those opinions gotten more extreme? Have we just become more attuned to them? Are they just... there's just more of them, or is that a new phenomenon?
No, I don't think it's new at all. I think that this is just more widespread and it's more relevant. And it's something that, I mean, when you look at Ebola, I mean, yes, Ebola was a very dangerous, a deadly virus, but it was not easily spread as a pandemic, you know, across in different countries and things like that. You know, we're dealing with something that is much easier, much more virulent, much easier, much more infectious. And, you know, and for us now, it's much more relevant. You know, when Ebola is in Africa, us in the U.S., I mean, our interest is, for the most part, is just not there.
So it's really in my backyard kind of thing.
Right. It's exactly. I mean, yeah, so that's where I kind of see things. I mean, and that's where a lot of people view this as flip-flopping. And I just had this conversation today. I said, you know, when we first started doing this, we were literally changing things by the hour. You know, in March last year, I remember getting updates from the fire marshal's office, and we're looking at CDC data, and we're looking at all these different things. We're like, okay, well, now this is what we're going to do. Oh, wait a minute. Now something else happened. They figured something else out. Now we need to do this. And people interpret that as we don't know what we're doing, but, you know, again, like you said, we're doing this in real time. Like, we're figuring this out as we go along, and information is going to change. And for me, that didn't feel abnormal, because I'm used to that. Like, we in ICU, you know, we have a diagnosis. We think we know what's going on. Sometimes we don't know what's going on exactly. And we say, okay, well, it looks like this. Let's try this. Okay, well, that's not working. Let's try this now. And you know, you just keep doing that. They don't call it practicing medicine for a reason, because nothing's definite. But this is really the first time that this has been played out in front of, you know, the world.
Yeah.
And as transparent as it has been.
And people just don't understand the scientific method. That is kind of what it comes down to.
Well, yeah. I mean, and you know what, for most people, like, why would they, you know, I mean, if they're not involved in this, if they're not involved in this as a career, you know, why would they understand that? Or why would they take an interest in that necessarily? And the part where I mentioned about the election year and the politics of everything comes into play is when you have, nothing frustrates me more than having healthcare providers who throw what they know about the scientific method and about science out the window for ulterior motives. And that has been the absolute.
What have you seen? Good. That's if you didn't go there, I was going to take you there. So to the degree that I can appreciate the point about people who don't know better, because if you're an artist and your entire world is art, you don't necessarily understand how viruses get made or tested. There's no reason you should.
Right. But, in the same that if you were an artist and I went to an art gallery and I was looking at a painting, I would not appreciate that to the same level that
Agreed.
That would. You know, what I found,
I've personally been on the affected by this, is I tend to believe, again, sacred cows and data cubes, right? We need to poke the science. Science is supposed to be about proving people wrong, right? That's its game, is either confirm over time that you were right, or prove that you were wrong and find something new, replace the null hypothesis, et cetera, right?
Right.
And that's what it's supposed to be. If this is a conspiracy theory, someone has to win in a conspiracy, right? There has to be a goal, unless it's pure anarchy, which is, I guess, a whole different ballgame. But even there, someone wins. We don't have pure anarchy. We have people wearing masks and things like that, but laws haven't come crumbling down. So who wins in this situation from those ulterior motives? What do you see as the motives that people have been trying to advance that make any kind of rational sense?
So I don't think a lot of people are real rational with this. And I think that's part of the problem is they think they're being rational. They think they're making a rational argument but they aren't willing to see the other side of the argument, and they aren't willing to see how their perception of things.
I feel like on the one hand, we're talking about entrenchment, right? Sorry to push the issue, but I think it's fascinating. As I mentioned, you've got this in the ground, you know, in the trench view of it, where if you're a really smart person, if you're a PhD in XYZ, whether or not you understand science is a whole different, or the, you know, again, PhD, you probably have some idea what that is, but if you simply kind of, the idea that all you're doing is regurgitating what you heard on NPR, read on a bumper sticker, or, you know, whatever, that's kind of beneath you, right? So what makes folks, their brain kind of falls out of the head? And that's what I haven't
really thought. I agree 100%. I will put politics on here.
Yeah.
So
this is no holds barred, man. Good.
Yeah. So I voted Republican. I vote Republican almost exclusively.
You're in Texas.
But I don't vote. What's that?
You're in Texas. It's a thing to do.
I know. But the thing is, like, here's the thing, and this is what's not happening with a lot of these people is you and I have very different political opinions on things. We have very different voting opinions on things.
I agree, okay? More than you think.
However, right. And however, we agree on a lot. And we can say, hey, I don't have to agree 100% with everything every Republican does. And you don't have to agree 100% with everything every Democrat does. We can say, well, for the most part, they represent our interests, and that's why we vote that way. But for these things, they're wrong.
Yeah.
And this is the part where these things are falling apart, because things are so polarized right now politically that there's so much entrenchment on either side, the far left, far right, whatever you want to say, that people are forgoing the common sense part of this, and they are sticking with that basic, like, kind of carnal belief of these things and saying, well, I'm not giving up my position, even though I know that that information is right and the other person has said something that makes sense to me. I can't admit that, because then I'm giving up my position.
So let me take that to a very practical place. And we've still got a couple months that I'm gonna bring you back to. But let's talk about registries for a second. So for those who don't realize, those who don't know, a registry is basically a database with personal information, right? That's kind of where the highest level view. And there is an executive at the state of Texas who I have been talking to for the last several weeks about, I won't mention his name, but he is a very smart guy, and his focus is interoperability. So his focus is data capture, data movement, data validation, all this stuff. And I basically said to him, in light of very much what you just described, and this is why I wanted to mention it here, I said exactly this. How did we end up in this mess? Right? Because even if you look at politics of same-sex marriage, taxes, homelessness, education policy, should you have to wear a mask, Second Amendment, all this stuff, right? Take all of those things. Theoretically, the question of whether Narcan wakes up an overdose patient with an opioid overdose, that's not a political question.
Right.
So science, medicine is...
Well, it shouldn't be.
Right. Historically, that has not been the case. And so I asked him, point blank, how did we end up in this mess where information is not being transferred, data identities are not being validated? We're going to get into some of that detail, because I'm going to ask you to geek out a little bit on your experience. But at the end of the day, the most powerful, wealthiest scientific leader by many measures in the world, i.e. the United States, came up with a stupid little piece of paper, about yay big, right? With handwriting on it and an ID on it that so many people then put pictures of online, that CNBC and others said, stop doing that because identity theft, right?
That's
what we got, right? And I saw one of the most interesting political cartoons, again, speaking of politics and all that, just about a couple days ago, right? It's 2021, we were promised flying cars, we got objections to Mr. Potato Head's gender, right?
Right.
So something is wrong. And so I asked this guy, how did we end up in a situation where science has been deprecated and the best we could do was a card that could get mistaken for a reminder to go to jury duty? And his answer was, over the last several years, in the case of the paper that I published at GEMS, it talks about how 8 years ago, federal bureaucrats at the National Institute of Standards and Technology identified problems with data sharing between electronic health records and immunization registries 8 years ago, and nothing got done to fix it. And so he mentioned two things. He said, one, we tend to think in short bursts, right? So when 9/11 happens, we tend to think about national security and airlines, and we create color coding systems, and we start taking off the shoes at the airport, right?
Right.
When the Superdome is inundated by water, we tend to think about hurricanes, right? And so on. When California is burning, we tend to think about it, and then we're on to the next cycle. So again, media and the 24-hour super cycle and the whole thing, right? And that's one problem. That's a very big social problem in terms of our attention span has been fractured. But at the same time, he talked about the bastardization of the funding mechanism. And basically said, we know that there are problems associated with things like interoperability, but we keep raiding the pot, right? And so then when you finally do need to figure out how to close these gaps, you find that the coffers are dry. And so that's where science does become political, because I remember when I was in college, right, my English professors would talk about how every quote that you put into an article is a choice. You choose which studies to cite and which authors to cite, and you're making a political statement by who you reference, right?
Right.
Yep. If you choose to fund public health or not to fund public health, you are making a political statement. And you may be long out of office by the time that becomes a shit show. But we're in it now. And so there seems to be a moral hazard in the idea that you fund something 10 years ago or make a decision to, as the government did, to basically say, we know there's these problems, but the administration has shifted. And whereas at one point we thought that government needs to be the ones to lead the interoperability effort, that was done under a democratic, liberal-leaning administration. And now we're in a Republican, conservative-leaning administration, and we want to leave that interoperability bits to the private sector, right? To market forces. It was actually the word they used, market forces. And so what strikes me as really problematic is those don't jive, right? So you essentially set yourself up to fail, because one administration says, I'm going to pander to this group. The other administration says, I'm going to pander to this group. And no one bothers to say, Chief Cassiotti, what are you going to need? Right? And if it hits the fan, I mean, we are in the emergency services business. And I think that's why I'm so fascinated by this. Because if we were in the painting murals on the side of business building, you know, on the side of buildings business, then there's no reason we should be prepared for what happens when a pandemic shows up, or a hurricane shows up, or fires, or a 100-car pileup in Dallas, right? But we're not in that business. We're supposed to be building for contingency plans. So how did we end up here, in your opinion? Like, what do we do? Someone, the call I had just before talking to you today was referencing COVID-22, not COVID-21. We have the chance to learn from our mistakes now. So when we look at where we've been, and we look at where we go, and realize that our attention span is going to shift again, what would you tell the world to do? How do we end up here? How do we fix this and divorce it from politics while standing on one foot?
You know, I think, I'll speak to my approach here at our department as to how, because I've got some very strong opinions. You know, we're a combined fire and EMS department.
Yeah.
So there's some strong opinions related to, we have some people on the suppression side that don't like EMS essentially telling them how to do their job. There's also strong opinions politically as to whether things should be a certain way versus another. The way that I've tried to approach this with everybody is that I'm here to provide you information to allow you to make the best educated decision that you can. There's certain things that we have to have in place. I think the more and more you push people to the extremes, either way, the more and more pushback you're going to get. You're going to have two groups. You're going to have three groups of people. You're going to have the groups that think that the whole world should be locked down until this is over. The group that thinks that we should never have locked anything down and that they're never, ever, ever going to get this vaccine, no matter how good it is or no matter how much we can prove it's safe. Yeah. And then you're going to have the larger amount of people in the middle that are just not sure.
The centrists, too.
And, you know, they're kind of leaning one way or the other. And those are the ones that I'm trying to reach. I'm not trying to reach the extremes, because the extremes have made up their minds.
Yep.
And I really think if we take that approach, that's really the best thing that we can do. And, you know, we've talked before about this, these islands of success that people have. And, you know, really, community paramedicine is a prime example. There's no real national standard for it. There's no state standard for it. It's very specific. In EMS in general, there's no standardization between the states. When I started my EMS career in Pennsylvania, where we had very stringent state guidelines, what the state says you can and can't do, and you cannot exceed those.
Yep.
To Texas, where there's really not many state guidelines, and you're pretty much allowed to do whatever your EMS medical director allows you to do, which is why here we're allowed to do essentially critical care flight medicine on the ground. So it's really hard to come up with a way to do things when you're that far apart on things, and you're not having all these different places talk to it to each other. And you know, when we start to talk about this vaccine registration data, I mean, this is where this is going to be key, because I got comments the other day from somebody. They said, well, do you think that they're going to require proof of vaccination to fly places? Do you think they're going to require proof of vaccination to go on cruises? And I said, well, I mean, I can give you my personal opinion. I haven't officially, I mean, I don't know anything, but I would imagine that probably that yes, that there, those restrictions would be put in place. So if I fly to Florida and I'm flying back from Florida to, I mean, and I filled out those white cards from the CDC, I mean, anybody can write their name on it and fudge a bunch of numbers on it and take it somewhere and say, hey, I got my vaccine. And if I'm in Florida, they have no way to look and see if I have my immunizations in electronically, because Florida isn't going to be able to access the Texas ImmuTrack registry.